All right, so Matt, last night we all went walking around the neighborhood, get a little exercise, you know. And as we're walking, I saw a slice of apple pie on the street.
That's odd.
And I thought it was weird. So we kept walking, and then there was an ice cream sundae sitting at the corner of the street. Huh. We turn the corner, and I see a cheesecake. And I turned to Ashley, and I went, man, the streets are really deserted tonight.
I could feel it after the cheesecake. I could feel it, but I didn't know how it was going to go. I knew dessert was going to be a part of it. That's great. Good, good.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales. All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
I'm doing pretty good, man.
Good. Good. I wish I was deserted right now. A cheesecake sounds amazing. Shit,
man, I'm telling you, I have not had any kind of real dessert in so long. Yeah. I am afraid that it would make me sick as a dog at this point.
Dude, we've cut out a lot of that, and like our desserts are like marshmallows and stuff, but we went out to eat the other night and decided we were going to get a dessert, and we were sick. We literally got nauseous. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So before we get into it, and before we go off on a dessert tangent,
right.
I'll say this couple things in Graveyard Tales news. One is coming up. Don't forget, we have our Halloween live stream that will be Halloween night.
That's right.
Check our social medias for the time and where you can find the link and all that. Also, if you haven't yet, it'll be here before we know it, where our listener stories episodes are, we're going to be doing that before we can blink.
You're exactly right, man.
So if you haven't already sent in your listener stories for this year, please send it to us. Put in the subject listener stories, or you know, listener stories 2025 or something like that. Go ahead and get it to us. The earlier you get it into us, the earlier in the episode that your story will run. We've already gotten a few. So if you're interested in having a story showcased on our Christmas episodes, please send us a story. We love those stories. We couldn't have those episodes without y'all.
That's right.
100% on y'all. And y'all have knocked it out of the park every year with your stories.
Yeah, so, no doubt.
So keep it up. We love it. And we're going to be, before we know it, we'll be giving you a deadline for when those need to be in. So do that as soon as you can. Also, go over to patreon.com/graveyardtales. Sign up to become a patron. We've got 3 different levels that you can sign up for. And you get a whole back catalog of bonus episodes that we've been doing for years. Matt, has it been 6 years that we've been doing Patreon? Something like that? Six or seven?
Maybe pushing close to 7.
Yeah.
I think we started it after the first year or so. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yep. So we've got a bunch of years of episodes that you can go back and listen to on our dark weeks, or, you know, if you just need something to fall asleep to and you need the monotonous drone of my voice, then go over there and become a patron. Also, our $5 and $10, they get the ad free audio and video versions of the main episode if we have an ad that week. Yeah. If we don't, it goes up for everybody ad free because it's ad free. But also, our $10 a month patrons, they get all of that, plus they get our second show, Side Quest, which is just me and Matt goofing, telling stories about things that we've done, playing games. It's like if you were hanging out with me and Matt at home having a beer, That's what it is. And just, it's not super family friendly. You know, if you got,
no,
if you've got teenagers, maybe, but it's not like Graveyard Tales, where Graveyard Tales is PG, PG-13. It's not on side quests. So you get a more adult oriented show if you're into such things.
Right.
But Matt, that's all I've got for the housekeeping. So before I give my line, I'm just going to say, y'all, saddle up, get ready.
Yeah.
Pull your hat down so it doesn't blow off in the wind. But Matt, why don't you tell us, what are we talking about tonight, brother?
Oh man. We wanted to try and get a little bit scarier.
Mm-hmm.
And so poking around, we decided, let's talk about this place. You know, we've kind of looked for some true crime that leads to some haunting. This one is like the extreme of
yeah.
true crime and hauntings combined. Yep. But it is just, I don't know. This one is kind of gruesome in spots. Yep. So just be aware of that. But we are going to discuss the Villisca axe murder
mm-hmm.
house.
Yep.
We're talking about the house, but we can't talk about the house without talking about the actual murders as well. You've got to, it's another case where you have to understand the history to understand the hauntings.
Right.
And I tell you, I feel like I've read this story so many times now. I'm just kind of like, I don't know if you felt this way, Adam, the time frame, the era where this occurred is so out of the ordinary.
Yep.
You know, the event itself is so unbelievably outside of the norm.
And the actions taken
yeah.
are so outside of the norm, too.
Everything about this is just, it's like you're reading a fiction novel. It's not like this actually happened, but it did.
Right, right.
It did. So the Villisca axe murder house, I can't even, we're going to have to just get into it.
Yeah. Okay? Right.
So Adam, tell us about this case. Tell us about the history of this house, and the town of Villisca, Iowa.
All right. So as we always say, go check our sources down in the bottom of the show notes. You can find where we found all this information, and everything we talk about is referenced and sourced in our show notes. So you can go down there and double check us. You can, whatever you want to do. It's down there in the show notes. Check them out if you're interested. Now, the Villisca axe murders occurred overnight between June 9th and June 10th, 1912.
1912
in Villisca, Iowa. So, you know, I don't think of a small town like Villisca, Iowa as a place that something like this would happen.
Not even in the modern era.
Right.
But right. especially not in,
right.
you know, turn of the century Midwest America.
Yep. Yep. It's crazy. Now, it resulted in the deaths of 8 people, including 6 children. So it is going to be a little gruesome. I'm going to keep a lot of the blood and gore down, but we do have to talk about some of it.
Yeah.
So in the spirit of Halloween month, we are going to get a little bit more gruesome than we probably normally would. Before we get into the axe murders, I think first we need to talk about forensic technology. And the early 1900s didn't have the forensic technology like we have today. They didn't even have a lot of the basic fingerprint technology that we take for granted now and call antiquated.
Right, yeah.
They had fingerprints, yes, don't get me wrong. But the ability to tie fingerprints to a specific person was very difficult, long and drawn out. And the ability to get the fingerprints was a lot more difficult than it is nowadays.
Yeah, I'm looking. It says fingerprinting started in around 1892.
Mm-hmm.
So only 20 years before this, and it was used in a case to identify a murderer in Argentina.
Right.
So it not even in the U.S.
Right.
So it just, I mean, that just kind of gives you an idea of this was still in its infancy.
Yep. And the way it had to be done at that point is if you are able to collect the fingerprint, then you save that fingerprint, and then you have to get a fingerprint from somebody else and sit there manually looking at the swirls and the loops and checking it. It was very tedious. And obviously there was no database. They didn't have like a flip book of criminals' fingerprints that they had been taking for 20 years. It wasn't even mandatory at that point that if you got arrested, you had to give your fingerprints.
Fingerprinted, yeah.
So it was, like Matt said, in its infancy. And that plays into this case quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, the murders occurred during the night between June 9th and June 10th of 1912. Now, the initial investigator said that the murders actually probably occurred between midnight and 2 a.m., so they were able to narrow it down. The way they did that back then was they used liver temperature a lot of times. So your liver sits at a certain temperature, and then it loses degrees at a certain rate based on the temperature of the room. And if they're in a house, you're able to kind of calculate with the ambient temperature and the temperature of the liver. I'm too dumb to know exactly how to do it. I don't math good, and this requires math. But that's how they would do it. They would take the liver temperature, and they would be able to narrow it down and say, okay, they died 12 hours ago.
It seems like
give or take
to do that, you have to be pretty close to the time of death, because at some point the body is going to be cold. It's not going to get any colder to let you know.
Yeah.
So if you found a body, say 3 days.
Yeah.
I mean,
you're right.
It's not going to help.
It would be no good. Yeah. Yeah. It wouldn't do any good. It has to be very, I think, within the first 24 hours of death or something.
Yeah.
And it has to be in a fairly controlled environment. Because if you're outside, then your whole equation changes if it's super cold or super hot.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And remember, too, not only was the technology limited around the world, we're talking about a tiny little town at this time in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, farming community, one of these areas where your closest neighbor, you may have to walk a mile if you were going to get to them.
Even nowadays, there's small towns that don't have forensic departments and have to call in the state.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's 2025.
Yeah.
So think about 1912.
Right.
The forensic technology was not, I mean, it was there, but it might as well not be, I hate to say that, but
I mean that's just true. I mean, you're going to find it in large cities, but you're not going to find it probably much further out than what would be considered a suburb.
Right. Now, on the morning of June 10th, a neighbor, Mary Peckham, noticed that the Moore house was quiet. Josiah Moore, she said, was usually out early doing chores, stuff around the house, get it done before it gets hot. But that morning, The curtains were drawn. The doors were locked and no one was outside. So by mid-morning, Mary went over. She was concerned. She knocked on the door, and when she didn't get an answer, she went over to the chicken coop and let the Morse chickens out, and then went back to her house, and she called Josiah's brother, Ross Moore, to check on the family. At around 8 a.m., Ross arrived. He had a key to the house, so he unlocked the door, and he stepped into the house. It was dead silent in the house. It was dark. Nothing was moving. Now, Mary, she stayed out on the porch because she was uneasy. Something didn't feel right to her, and she didn't want to go in. So Ross entered the living room. And when he entered the living room, he discovered the bodies of two Stillinger girls, Ina, who was 8, and Lena, who was 12. They had been sleeping over at the Moore's house that night. Now, they had clearly been killed violently in their sleep, it says. So Ross was horrified, so he didn't go any further into the house. He ran back outside, went over to Mary's house, and he called Josiah's hardware store, telling an employee there to go fetch the town marshal, Henry Hank Horton. So Horton arrived shortly after this phone call, and he searched the house room by room. In the upstairs bedroom, he found Josiah Moore and his wife, Sarah, bludgeoned in their bed. In another room adjacent to that were the Moore children, Herman, 11, Catherine, 10, Boyd, 7, and Paul, 5, and they were all murdered in their beds. Now, the Stillinger girls were downstairs where they had been sleeping, and the rest of the Moore family was upstairs. In total, like I said, there were 8 victims. Now, they were all killed with an axe that belonged to Josiah Moore. The heads of the victims had been covered with sheets or clothing, and the mirrors in the house had been draped with cloths or towels. And they said these were details that made the crime scene especially unsettling. I would say the bludgeoning would make it especially unsettling.
Absolutely.
But yes, draping the mirrors and the heads with clothes does not help. Now, the axe that belonged to Josiah Moore was left leaning against the Stillinger girls' beds that they'd been sleeping in. But the killer had washed it. Even though he had washed it, he left some traces of blood on the axe so they could pinpoint this was the murder weapon. There was also a plate of uneaten food that was left on the kitchen table. There was a basin full of water, full of bloody water there. So it was apparent that the killer had, they say, calmly washed up before leaving. So, quick recap. The victims were Josiah Moore, who was a local businessman, his wife Sarah, their 4 children, Herman, Catherine, Boyd, and Paul Moore, and 2 young guests of the family, Ina and Lena Stillinger. So let's look at the investigation. Now, after the initial investigation had begun, they say disaster struck. And I would say this is a disaster because word of the crime spread like wildfire across this small town. So by mid-morning, dozens of townsfolk were filing through the house. They were
it's crazy to me.
Yeah, you did not secure the crime scene. So townspeople are walking through the house. They're looking into bedrooms. They're touching walls.
Mm-hmm.
They're stepping over bloodstains.
Yeah.
So the crime scene is contaminated beyond repair before investigators can even really begin the investigation. All right, everybody, let's take a second and talk about tonight's sponsor, MeUndies. Now, y'all know that we love MeUndies, but fall is here now. So the beers are colder, football's back, you're hanging out around the fire pit outside, but if you're still rocking your beat-up boxers under all those layers of flannel and jeans and stuff, we got to talk. You have got to upgrade to MeUndies. They're ridiculously soft. They're like, I don't want to take them off soft. And they're made of a micromodal fabric that feels like a cloud, but they still breathe. So when you're sitting around the campfire and getting all warm and toasty, you don't have to worry about sweating in certain areas. And they have limited edition Halloween prints that are out now. They're fun, they're festive, and they've got glow-in-the-dark underwear. So you can have that spooky Halloween vibe underneath everything else you're wearing. They've got a cut for every butt with over 20 different styles in 100 different colors and prints. Like I said, they're super soft. They got micromodal fabric that's breathable, stretchy, and unbelievably cozy. They are sustainably sourced, and they work with partners that care about their workers. If you're not happy with your first pair of MeUndies, guess what? It's on MeUndies. Now, with more than 30 million pairs sold and 90,000 five-star reviews, MeUndies are an essential fall must-have for every drawer. And right now, as listeners of Graveyard Tales, you can get cozy and spooky for less with deals up to 50% off at MeUndies.com/graveyard and enter our promo code Graveyard, GRAVEYARD. That's MeUndies.com/graveyard, promo code Graveyard for up to 50% off. MeUndies. Comfort that's made for every season. Now, I'm sorry, but I don't care if you've got a whole town coming or not. A few sheriff's deputies should be standing at the door, turning them away.
Yeah. See, I can't imagine that the understanding of evidence preservation and the importance of seeing the crime scene as it was, was not something that was already known and being done.
Right.
Okay. I mean, you think about this. Scotland Yard is old. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I use them as an example because you're talking about an old agency that, you know, was a leader in crime investigation.
Right.
Not just technology, just procedure. You know, how to use all of this and how to take care of evidence, how to make these deductions and things like that. So at 1912, some law enforcement would have known this is not the way it needs to be.
Right.
You know, but it happened anyway. People just milling around and why would you want to?
Yeah. What would possess you as a towns member to go, my neighbors, they were slaughtered in their house. So you know what? I'm going to walk through. I want to see this.
Yeah.
You know, I want to go over and peek in on the neighbors. I've always wanted to see their house. What a good time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah, right now.
God. So, yeah.
It's nuts to me. I don't know.
It baffles me how you let those people just file through. You know, you got to preserve your crime scene.
Well, and one of the articles that I read, it really made it sound like that they were overwhelmed with people, that there were so many just coming, you know, once the word got out.
Yep.
I mean, you know, most of the articles you find about it talk about this, that tragedy struck.
Yeah.
And it's all about the word of the murder getting out.
Yep.
Because people just came from everywhere.
Well, you know what you do? You got a key to that house. You lock
it up.
The door. And you know what? If you got to lock an investigator inside so they can get the stuff done quick, do it.
Yeah.
But you lock it, and then you put a sheriff's deputy out front with a shotgun and say, hey, crime scene, you fools. Wait. When we're done, if you really want to traipse through this crime scene, we'll let you, but we need to get done first.
Mm-hmm.
But before, and they had the herds of people trampling through the crime scene, there were some oddities about this crime scene. One is they found a gas lamp with this glass chimney removed and the wick was turned all the way down. They found that in the house. And they said it was likely used to keep the light extremely dim while the killer moved through the house, committing the acts. One of the other oddities I've already mentioned, covering all the mirrors and the victim's faces with cloth. And they said this detail was noted for its ritualistic nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now,
and it adds a significant creep factor to it, but it also kind of gives you some indication of maybe what this person's mindset was.
Yep. Some insight into the killer.
Yeah.
Now, this next part is probably the roughest part that I've got. So tune out for 45 seconds or so if
it's too much. Yeah.
Yeah. If you can't handle that, because I can barely handle talking about it. So I'm going to start talking about it and just like turn the volume down or skip ahead about 45 seconds. Now, the bodies of the Stillinger girls had been repositioned. Ina was placed face down with her backside up in the air. Lena's undergarments had been removed and her body was posed to reveal her genitalia, though Lena did not appear to have been molested. But she had been staged that way. Okay. Got that over with.
Yeah.
Back to normal. That's rough. J.B. Moore's wallet containing cash was untouched. So they were able to kind of rule out robbery since obvious point of cash was not rifled through and the cash taken. Now, the murderer reportedly took out a slab of bacon from the icebox, wrapped it in a towel, and placed it on the ground in a downstairs bedroom near the girls. Nobody has been able to explain why he did this. So I don't know what kind of ritualistic or symbolic anything this would be to take a frozen slab of bacon out and wrap it in a towel and set it by the bodies.
It's such an odd detail.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just makes no sense.
No, but it does, again, look into the mindset of the killer,
mm-hmm.
who shows that he was not in his right mindset.
Right, exactly.
He was off. Now, in the barn, there was an imprint in the hay next to a knot hole, and they said this was interpreted as a place where the murderer may have watched the house before entering. All the valuables were left untouched in the house, not just the cash, but all the valuables. The mirrors being covered, the faces being covered, the children's bodies being moved, and there were certain features of the crime scene that implied premeditation and ritualistic actions. They call them two spent cigarettes. But I'm going to say two smoked cigarettes
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
were found in the attic suggesting that the killer may have entered the house and waited in the house for the family to return and fall asleep, because they had been, I'll talk about it more in a minute, but they had been predisposed that evening with a gathering, a get together,
right,
that they put on. Now, the contamination of the scene, the axe was handled by spectators and it was moved from room to room before the scene was sealed by officials. So not 100% sure where it was left in the first place.
Right.
Because these jack wagons went through moving evidence. Bloodhounds attempted to pick up the killer scent from the axe, but because it had been tampered with, it was not successful. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get any leads on it because there was maybe 75 different smells from the neighbors there. So the bloodhound couldn't follow anybody. Now, there were no fingerprints collected, and the coroner neglected proper crime scene documentation, leaving no thorough notes about body positioning and detailed forensics. So the coroner, as my granddad would have said, did a piss poor job. Now, within days, rumors spread and people started bringing up suspects that they thought. Well, one rumor that was started in the newspaper was that the family had all been sedated in some way. But toxicological testing was not a thing that they did back then.
Yeah.
And so it remains unproven.
And I wonder how
they could do it. Well, they could do it. If you, there's ways that you can draw the blood and see if like there's a substance in there.
Mm-hmm.
It would not necessarily be able to tell you what was in the blood, but it could tell you something was in the blood or that there was alcohol in the blood. And it wasn't a routine thing because it was not a proven science at the time.
And I was curious too, like how, what would have been available at the time for the killer to have done that? If that's indeed what they did,
mm-hmm.
Because I would think, okay, you've got 8 people and you're going to sedate them.
Yeah.
You would almost
inject or chloroform.
Yeah, which you know you couldn't do that to 8 people at once. So
right,
I'm like, what gas or something? I mean, how would they even go about doing that at that in 1912? But
yeah,
I don't know. I thought it was very curious.
It is. I wouldn't know how you could sedate 8 people at once.
I thought you would know.
No, I'm too stupid for that, Matt. I'm just a dumb podcaster. I don't know that crap. The one thing I do know is that they were not drunk in any way.
Yeah.
Because that is an easy tell. If they are really drunk, the blood actually smells like booze. I don't know if you know that or not, but even to this day, a lot of crime scene investigators and everybody can tell, the victim was very intoxicated because the blood will smell like liquor. And
makes sense.
They don't even have to do a test. They just walk up and go, smells like Jack Daniels. Mm. You know, these people were drunk. That's an easy one, and the coroner could do a piss poor job and still figure that one out.
Yeah.
Now some of the suspects that were thrown around were Frank Jones, a wealthy local businessman and state senator. Josiah had worked for him before starting his own store, taking Jones's biggest account with him.
Mm-hmm.
So the town whispered about a murder for hire scheme with this guy. But just one of those rumors that came out. Another one was a man named William Mansfield. He was later suspected of multiple axe murders across the Midwest, and he had ties to the Jones family through business rivals. Then, the strangest suspect of all of them was Reverend George Kelly. He was a traveling preacher who had a reputation for, quote, odd behavior and mental instability. He apparently had attended the Children's Day service that the Moores had hosted the night before, and some say they saw him watching the house that night.
That's an odd thing there. I mean, mm-hmm. why would he be out there?
Yeah. Why would he be looking at the house?
Yeah.
At all. Now, investigators reconstructed the night's events mainly by interviewing neighbors and townspeople. Like I said, the evidence collection practices were rare and not widely used at the time. Mm. And even if they were, the crime scene had been just ravaged by the neighbors. And a coroner's inquest was held on June 11th of 1912, quickly following the discovery of the bodies. 13 witnesses were interviewed, but no one was formally charged or arrested based on subsequent testimony. But apparently, the case spiraled out of control at this point. Local police, county sheriffs, and even private detectives all launched competing investigations, a lot of times working against the other group, hiding evidence from the other group, not telling them what they found, all wanting to be the ones to figure it out and sabotage sure. the other group.
Yeah.
Now, from what has been said, evidence went missing. There were leads that were not followed because they didn't, quote unquote, find them credible. And you won't find that today. Every lead is run down by a good police force.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter how dumb it sounds, they're going to run it down to make sure it's not, that it's true or not true. But right. they didn't do yeah. that.
Rule it out.
Right.
It's like from a medical standpoint, you know, we do a lot of tests when, you know, there's a problem, somebody's sick or something's going on. We do a lot of tests, but in many ways, those tests are designed to rule out other possibilities so that you can yep. narrow it down, because it, yep. it may not tell you 100% what it is, but it can certainly tell you what it's not.
Well, and even when you're pretty sure that that's not the outcome, you need to do it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, I'm almost 100% sure they don't have Guillain-Barré syndrome, but we're going to test for Guillain-Barré just to make sure.
Yeah.
And then, okay, when it's not that, we can run down to something else. That's not the way this investigation was handled, supposedly. And they'd get a lead and go, nah, that can't be it, and not do it. Well, through all this, the town itself split into different factions. Half of them were convinced that Jones had orchestrated the murders. The other half were convinced that Reverend Kelly had orchestrated the murders or was the killer. Years went by. No arrest had been made. Nothing. Now, in 1917, Reverend Kelly was arrested after allegedly confessing to the murders during a grueling interrogation.
Yeah.
So he went to trial, but they had a very weak case against Kelly. His confession was inconsistent, and a lot of people believe that it was coerced.
Yeah, probably was.
Probably was.
I mean,
just to
for it to come
get
up
a
like
conclusion.
It did. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just to get a conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
6 years, 5 years after the murders, but he went to trial. The first trial ended in a hung jury, so they took him to trial again. Well, the second trial ended in an acquittal for him. So after that, Mansfield was also briefly arrested, but he had an alibi, so that set him free. And Frank Jones was never charged with anything. So some of the stuff I found on the legacy that this investigation left behind was a lack of standardized procedures, contaminated evidence, and sensationalist reporting contributed to the enduring mystery. So the fact that they needed more evidence collection standards and stuff like that, the fact that they had let people just traipse through the crime scene, move evidence around, touch things, all this stuff, and because the papers at the time had reported a bunch of wild theories about something, all contributed to this not being able to have a conclusion. And the investigative shortcomings of the era, they say, have made Villisca a frequent topic in discussions on early American criminal investigation and forensic history. So it's used in different scenarios as what not to do. And here's what happened back in the day when we didn't have these procedures that we have now. So, as this said, it said the Villisca axe murder investigation illustrates the limitations of early 20th century forensics and procedural challenges that plagued unsolved crimes of the period. So, I knew before getting into this that the investigation had been bungled. But I had no idea how badly this investigation had been bungled and it was a complete show from the beginning.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. And, you know, that's why you wound up with no solid suspects. A lot of them were just rumored, or mm-hmm. It was just, you know, they were the low-hanging fruit. No real evidence to point to a single suspect. And the only real trial, you know, was railroaded by most likely a coerced or, you know, just disingenuous confession. So yeah, I mean, it's just totally outrageous, you know, when you go through all these details. But a lot of people look at this and they said, you know, you combine all the real oddities to it, the bacon left out, the faces covered, the windows and mirrors covered. I mean, you can understand, mm-hmm. I'll cover the windows so no one can actually come by and see what you're doing. But if you're covering the windows, then why do you have to keep the light so low? Why would you cover the mirrors? Which does kind of, well, to me, it, because of what we know about mirrors and the realm of spiritualism, which was, you know, a very hot thing at this time. Not necessarily in the Midwest, but definitely in larger cities.
And it could have been in the Midwest. I don't know.
But the use of mirrors in spiritualism and trying to commune with the dead was very common.
Mm-hmm.
And
there was the old practice of covering mirrors when a person was dying or dead in their house so that their soul didn't get trapped.
There you go. You know,
so,
which maybe this is what the killer was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I cover the mirrors so the souls don't get trapped inside this house or inside the mirror. Which just adds a whole nother creep factor to this case.
It sure does.
But what if the souls did get trapped in this house? And we've talked a lot about hauntings where, you know, the spirits had an abrupt, a violent, or an untimely death that kind of led their spirit to kind of be stuck, you know, in time, unable to move on.
Right.
So there's a really good theory out there that the paranormal activity that occurs in the Villisca murder house is due to the way this family met such a violent end, and their souls weren't even aware of what was going on, and they're just stuck.
Yep.
Now, before we get into the actual hauntings, I want to talk a little bit about Reverend Kelly, because he does seem like such a odd guy. He was a self-ordained minister, and he was new to town. The idea was is that he said as Reverend Kelly was walking closer to the house, he heard the voice of God telling him to, quote, follow the shadow. Now, the shadow he spoke of led him directly to the Moore house and to the axe in the shed. And he said that he was told to, quote, slay them all. But it was also found out that Reverend Kelly was possibly schizophrenic and just made it up, because, as we said, he was never convicted.
Right.
But a lot of people believe that there is a darker presence inside the house, something much more disturbing, and that maybe Reverend Kelly did experience this dark shadow entity that lured him in there. Whether he actually did the killing or not, maybe he's not making that part up, that something was drawing him in.
Yep.
And possibly drew in another killer. But people in the Villisca axe murder house have claimed to have heard children's voices, seen abnormal shadows, and they've even heard disembodied footsteps coming from the attic. And that was the location where the suspected murderer may have waited for the Moore family to fall asleep.
Right.
And according to one legend, a fog is said to roll through the house around the same time as the grisly murders took place all those years ago, maybe symbolizing the lack of closure in the case.
That's crazy.
That was the only place I heard that reference, but I thought it was cool.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Tour guides have reported hearing footsteps when no guests were present, and items being moved around. Now, the house has been featured in countless documentaries, podcasts, and ghost hunting shows. And the teams have captured evidence like voice recordings or EVPs, unexplained knocks, and shadowy figures, some of which have actually been captured on film. So you can take the photographic evidence as you normally would. And, you know, a lot of people try to debunk these photos of shadows, or that it was, you know, a trick of the light, something wrong with the lens. You know, something was, though, if you position yourself this way, you would see an odd shadow from the light coming in from this window, whatever. But there are photos that you can look at that have been captured by numerous paranormal teams that have gone in there to investigate. Psychics have visited the house, and they say it's very active, but it's virtually impossible to tell if the presences there are victims, the murderer, or something else entirely. One of the theories is that, as I mentioned earlier, because of the way they were murdered in their sleep, they said the spirits may not even realize that they're dead. And therefore, they're not trying to move on. They're trying to understand, yeah. you know, what's going on, you know, and so they're kind of stuck in this loop between life and death, you know, not fully understanding that, hey, this happened to me.
Right.
Because a lot of people have thought, could these psychics that feel these presences, could they find the identity of the murderer? Because many of the EVPs include names. You know, there are multiple EVPs out there that have names of the family members.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And the psychics and the people that have reviewed them said, there's nothing coming across that says, I was killed, I was murdered, or I murdered anyone. You know, nothing like that. It's all just these, you know, random, you know, the names of the families or things like get out, leave. You know, they do hear the word murder. And these are pretty common during paranormal investigations. These EVPs, and some have even reported just audible voices, you know, so they didn't have to go back and listen to it.
Yeah.
Now, the one person that would probably be the expert on the goings on at the Villisca Axe Murder House is a paranormal investigator named Johnny Hauser. Now, Johnny worked and researched at the house for nearly 18 years.
Oh, wow.
Until the owner, Martha Lynn, sold the property in January of 2024. And when Martha and her husband owned the house, you know, Johnny would go by every so often. I didn't put it down. I think Martha's husband's name was like Delwyn or something. I can find and correct that, but
a unique name.
Yeah, it was a very unique name. But he said that he would talk to him, like he'd be out working in the yard and they would get to talking and everything. And then Johnny would be like, so what do you think? How do you think he did it? You know, which suspects, you know, which ones stick out in your mind, you know, just making conversation, but really truly interested in this case. Mm-hmm. Till one day, you know, Delwyn told him, look, you've come around here. You know so much about this. He goes, why don't you come to work for me, you know, and and help take care of this place. He goes, you know, as much about it as I do, maybe more. And so he did. And so Johnny Hauser was essentially the caretaker of the Villisca Axe Murder House. And he had gone in, this blew me away, and done like solo investigations to where he spent the night in the house alone. Jeez. 400 times.
What?
Yes. 400 times.
That is,
he spent the night in that house alone. Amount. Okay. And from what I understand, because Johnny's talked about this quite a bit, he lived either next door or close, very close, to where he would walk by the house and be able to talk to the owners. But yeah, so he would just spend the night in there to do, you know, investigations and try to, you know, catch some evidence, experience some of this paranormal activity. He says he had come in many times and would hear footsteps on the floor above him. You know, so he was like, I'm getting this. I'm experiencing this just coming in the middle of the day. What if I stayed here at night? And so that's what he did. And he said he hadn't been able to find a pattern of when it would happen. But he says in some ways it feels like the house is just messing with people. Just like a trickster spirit.
Yeah.
You know, he would do these, he would do recordings and he would get names, like I mentioned. But when he would go check, he would find the names of those that were listed as suspects. But he said that was half the town, you know. So, you know, the few suspects we mentioned, there were way more because anybody could have done it.
Yeah.
But he, and so he really thought, is this house just messing with investigators? Or, you know, have these victims not woken, having not woken up, do they really even realize they were victims? Now, one of Hauser's most memorable experiences occurred when he had positioned himself and one of his friends in a large closet with the door shut to do an EVP session. And so he says that he and his friend heard footsteps downstairs. And the footsteps started to come up the stairs toward him. So Johnny was convinced that someone had broken into the house. This is not the ghosty footsteps. This is somebody, a human being has come into this house and it's coming up these stairs. Which, like Adam and I have said, I'm much more scared of the living than I am of the dead.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%. 100%.
So he's hearing these heavy footsteps come into the room where the closet is, where he and his buddy are. So he thought, okay, I'm going to scare them, surprise them, and I'm going to kick the door open. Figured, element of surprise, if it is, you know, a burglar, I'm going to take them by surprise and I can maybe overpower
them. Right.
So when he kicks the door open, he expects to see an intruder there, but there was no one there.
No.
Yeah. So in 2021, Johnny Hauser appeared on the podcast Extremes, which was on, which is exclusive to Spotify. And he told the story of an amateur paranormal investigator that ended up harming himself inside the home while doing one of these solo investigations. This occurred in 2014. Johnny says the man, he said he looked to be about in his 50s at the time, arrived with his elderly parents. He told Johnny that he intended to, quote, give the house a piece of his mind.
That's weird.
Yeah, that's what Johnny thought, too. He was like, okay, well, good luck with that, you know. He's like, whatever. Yeah. I'm out. But this was part of Johnny's job as being the caretaker, would be to set up these investigations for these paranormal groups, you know, make sure they got settled in, understood, you know, what was going on, where they were, all that stuff.
Don't touch this. Don't break
this. Exactly. So this is what he had done. He was waiting outside. This guy pulls up. He said it was a little weird that he had his, you know, elderly mom and dad with him, but he thought, eh, maybe they're into it too, you know? So Hauser left them for the night and returned home. But the next morning when he woke up, he was tagged in all these social media posts describing a man who had stabbed himself in the axe murder house. So Johnny left the house. He says he called a few of his friends because he didn't really want to run over there by himself. But
sure,
he went in there and found the bloody evidence. I think one interview, he says there was a teddy bear like under a blanket and had blood on him. And he was like, no, not in this house again. Okay, man. But no body, just the evidence. And so he cleaned it up. He's the caretaker. He started cleaning it up. This is weird. What the hell's going on? And so he started cleaning it up. But later he learned that the man that he had let in to do an investigation had stood in the children's room and stabbed himself in the chest with a hunting knife. Yeah.
Really?
Now, the guy had been life flighted to a hospital in Omaha, and he survived this ordeal.
Oh, wow.
But you can imagine at the time, Hauser said he had no idea what had happened. He was just, after the fact, he was getting word back.
Yeah.
Can you imagine waking up and being tagged in all these news stories about something that happened to the person you were just with the night before?
No.
I mean, that's got to freak you out.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
But this is even stranger. Years later, this guy returned to the home with the paranormal show Kindred Spirits.
I know that.
Yeah. Johnny had the opportunity to talk to him and ask him what really happened. And he told Hauser that he had been alone in the bedroom provoking, trying to get the ghost to come at him. And then he said the next thing he remembers, he woke up in the emergency room and he couldn't remember a thing, you know, that happened.
Hey, I have never been a fan of provoking spirits.
Right.
I know a lot of people say that's how you get activity, and I know that's how a lot of people do it, but I think it's a dumb way to do it, to be honest with you, because if it's not the spirit of someone who has died, what are you provoking?
Right.
What are you bringing upon yourself? Yeah.
My thought on it is, if you believe in it enough that you're there doing an investigation, doing an actual ghost hunt, and you've bought into the fact that this could be real, then you would probably already have bought into the fact that dark entities possess homes like this sometimes.
Right, right.
And, you know, a ghost may not be able to hurt you, but a demon sure as heck could.
Yep, dark entity could.
Right, a shadow person, you know, something like that. So, yeah, talk about poking the bear.
No kidding.
Not the best plan, but it is very common in the world of paranormal investigation.
Yep. And I still don't know why. Yeah. It still makes no sense to me why you would want to do that.
Now, Hauser said that after the event in 2014, he never spent the night in the house again. He never felt that the house itself was evil, but that the evil deed that was done inside the home left a mark.
Sure.
And whatever emotion you brought to the house was what the house gave you in return.
Okay. Yep. I can see that.
So, you know, it
like a mirror.
Yeah. So, my thought on this whole thing, Adam, and I want to get your idea too.
Okay.
My thought on this is there potentially could have been an entity attached to this property.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that we have come across before is that people with mental illnesses, especially schizophrenia, seem to be more in tune with stuff like this.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're telling a therapist, you know, a psychiatrist about these voices. You know, I hear these voices and they tell me to do these horrible things. It just makes you wonder how much of that is the schizophrenia talking? How much is that? Is their head acting like a radio antenna for,
right,
you know, spirits or entities communicating through the veil? And could Reverend Kelly have indeed been schizophrenic and picked up on this dark entity telling him what to do, so that maybe this wasn't just fabricated? Maybe indeed there was something he picked up on. I'm not saying that Reverend Kelly was the one that did it, but
right.
Could he have picked up on this and heard the voices, you know, saying these things, but maybe they weren't saying it to him. Maybe they were saying it to whoever was actually doing the killing, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
And you wonder, well, why was Reverend Kelly watching the house? Maybe he was terrified that there was something inside that house.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he was watching it because he believed in his heart there was something evil, something dark that had taken up residence in there with this family. And too scared to go in, but wanted to maybe try to watch out as best he could.
For the family. Yeah. Warn them.
Yeah,
maybe the next day and just didn't get the chance or something.
It's possible. I mean, you see that there was some indication, some evidence that somebody had been sitting out in the barn, you know, possibly mm-hmm. watching them. But there's also the evidence, the cigarettes that show that somebody was in the attic waiting for them to return and fall asleep.
Yep.
So
yeah, could it have been two people at once?
Could it have been two? I think that is a distinct possibility. I think there could have been something in that house and may still be there.
That's what I was going to say.
Drew in these people that, and one of them, you know, committed this horrible crime.
Mm-hmm.
It would also, give a little bit more explanation. I can't think of a better word for this, but it doesn't really explain it. The food and the covering the mirrors and the covering of the faces and washing up, you know, all that kind of stuff of some individual that was absolutely not in their right mind, or even, you know, heavily influenced or possessed, you know, by something to do this.
The only other explanation I could give you for covering the faces is what some of these criminal psychologists have said is if they cover their victim, they are closely tied to that person, not like related to, mm-hmm. but had some type of close friendship or some relationship with, and they didn't want to see what they had done.
Mm-hmm.
So my thought is either that it was some ritualistic thing due to an entity in that area causing this person to do it, or the more tangible explanation is it was somebody that knew this family and these kids pretty closely and didn't want to sit there and dwell on what they had done.
I agree with that.
But I'm kind of with you on the, I feel like this house, and we don't talk about this often. We actually don't like talking about demonic, evil things because most things are not. Mm-hmm. They are out there, but we're not, Matt and I are not the kind to find a demon behind every pillowcase.
Right.
You know, so it's very rare that you'll hear us say something like this, but I do feel like this is one of the places in the world that there is a dark presence mm-hmm. on that land that I personally think had a hand in what happened there.
Yeah.
And could still be there. And that's why the
hauntings are still going on.
Because it's not, I mean, it's not like anyone resides there, you know? So, mm-hmm. I mean, you can imagine if a family had moved into this house and was living there, the activity might have ramped up.
Mm-hmm.
And there could have been another horrific event that occurred yep. once.
Similar to the Amityville house.
That's exactly what I was thinking, you know? And so in these possession cases that you and I have covered over the years where one individual seems to be targeted and it's just, we're going to dig, we're going to dig, we're going to poke, we're going to push until we break down their defenses and we can make them bend to our will, you know, as mm-hmm. far as, you know, this demonic entity. You know, to break their spirit and then either completely possess them or, you know, influence them in such a manner that they would perform such evil deeds. That takes time and it takes contact. And,
yep.
you know, this would be something where somebody would have to have lived there. Even somebody like Johnny Houser, who spent so much time in that house as a paranormal investigator, you know, he understood I'm dealing with something, you know, mm. I'm not 100% sure it's a demon. I'm not 100% sure it's ghosts, but I'm dealing with something, you know, there's too right. much going on here to just pass off. So, this is just a, it's a fascinating story for so many reasons. Mm-hmm. For the fact that it's an axe murder in 1912, the fact that, you know, the investigation the was so botched in such a way.
Yep.
The fact that, you know, no one was ever convicted of this crime, and the fact that mm-hmm. now, you know, there's so much evidence that there is something, a presence in that house, even to this day. So it just, it makes right. for a really, really crazy, cool, great story to discuss, especially yeah. right here around Halloween.
Mm-hmm. And the craziest part to me of this whole thing is the guy who stabbed himself decades later.
Look, If you can go and listen, you know, to Johnny Houser tell this story, but it is insane. You know, yeah. what could have possibly taken over this guy to do such a thing?
Yeah. Yeah. And to not have any recollection yeah. of it. Doesn't remember yeah. it at all.
And when he went back, Johnny said that the minute he walked in with him, when the first time he walked back into that house, said he looked up at the ceiling and basically apologized for what he had done. You know, like, I'm sorry to the house, because the yeah. house was what he was provoking and it caused him to do this. And that's just the way it looks. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I tell you this, I wouldn't have gone back, you know,
no.
I wouldn't have no. gone back. I wouldn't have been one to stay in there overnight, period. You know, I'm like, not a chance. I wouldn't have
provoked it in the first place.
Right.
No provoking.
Right. So, yeah, you're like, well, what would you have done? I wouldn't have been there. That's yeah. the whole yeah. thing.
At least not doing that yeah. there.
But there's so much information about the Villisca Axe Murder House. And a lot of it, thanks to Johnny Houser, is out there, and you can go and read about his experiences. You can, numerous paranormal investigations you can go and watch. If you want to dig a little bit deeper, then by all means, go for it. Cause it's, you know, Adam and I really just, you know, we dug pretty deep, but there's a lot further to go.
There's always more.
So let us know what you think. Do you think this house is possessed by some dark entity? Do you, you know, think there's a possibility that the spirits of this family is trapped inside there somehow. What do you think? And the best place to do that is in our Facebook group. It's called The Graveyard. We've got thousands of members in there sharing these ideas, telling personal stories, even cracking jokes. And it's great. It's a fun, safe place. It's a private group. So go in there and check it out. Don't forget to check out our website, which is graveyardpodcast.com. And there you can find links to purchase Graveyard Tales merchandise. You can listen to the show, and that is where you can become a patron. And thank you so much to everyone who has supported the work that Adam and I have done over the years. It has allowed us to keep the show as ad-free as we can do and keep it at a quality that Adam and I can be proud of and we know our listeners deserve. So yep. Until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.